The next specific matter on the agenda is State versus Solomon, number 20-0172. These will be 10-minute oral arguments. I reminded everyone, if there's anything confidential or private related information, these are public proceedings. They are being live streamed. They are being archived. So be cognizant of that today. And we would ask counsel for the appellant to introduce yourself. And it's Mr. Sell, is that correct?
That's correct, Your
Honor. And you are senior certified, is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and is Mr. Striggins available this morning?
He is, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Sell, if you would proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Mitchell Sell, senior certified law student under the supervision of Tom Striggins, Sarpy County Public Defender's Office, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Abram Solomon, in this matter. Your Honor, this case is not your typical case of the criminal appellant appealing the sufficiency of the evidence. Your Honor, what Mr. Solomon is asking this court to do today is look at the record and observe what evidence is absent entirely from the record. We're not asking this court to judge the credibility of evidence, to choose which witness to believe more or than the other. Mr. Solomon is asking this court to look at the record and look at the absence of any evidence of all the elements required to prove proximate cause. Your Honors, Mr. Solomon was charged with motor vehicle homicide while under the influence under Nebraska Revised Statute 28-306, specifically subsection 3B. Your Honors, when the legislature codified that statute, they wrote in proximate cause as the required element for causation. When the legislature writes proximate cause, it requires all of the elements of proximate cause. The state does not get to pick and choose which elements it proves. In a criminal case, the state has the burden of proving all the elements beyond a reasonable doubt. The honors, because in this case, the victim, Ms. Clausen, ignored her stop sign and pulled out into the lane of traffic in which Mr. Solomon had the right of way, the state was unable to prove all the elements of proximate cause because it could not prove that there was a lack of an efficient intervening cause. Now, Your Honors, I want to first address some case law that the state has relied on throughout trial and on appeal here to suggest that the negligence of a victim is not a defense in a motor vehicle homicide case. Your Honors, as I mentioned at the outset here, Mr. Solomon is not going to use the victim's negligence as a defense. Rather, her negligence illustrates the state's inability to prove its case in chief because they cannot prove there is no efficient intervening cause. So, Your Honor, specifically, the precedent the state relies on, Brown and William, are not applicable to today's case for two reasons. First, Brown and William may not be good law anymore after Irish was decided. Your Honors, the holding in William and Brown, the Nebraska Court of Appeals said, however, contributory negligence is not a defense to the charge of motor vehicle homicide. The issue is whether the defendant's violation of the law was a contributing factor to the death. Your Honor, that's not the standard anymore. The standard is not whether Mr. Solomon's actions were a contributing factor to the victim's death. The standard is whether Mr. Solomon's actions were the proximate cause of the death. Your Honor, the second reason why these two cases are not applicable and do not govern the instant case here, is in State versus Brown, the Nebraska Supreme Court actually remanded that case to impose a jury instruction on the negligence of the decedent. The court in that case relied on precedent from a few other jurisdictions, specifically the state of Arizona. Now, in Brown, the Nebraska court said that the Supreme Court of Arizona in State versus Shumway found it was error to refuse to give the instruction when requested because while contributory negligence of the victim is not a defense, the jury could still consider the victim's negligence regarding how it affected the element of causation.
Mr. Stell?
Yes, Your Honor.
Doesn't this really come down to whether or not the third party's negligence was reasonably foreseeable? And if it was, then it cannot constitute an efficient intervening cause as a matter of law, and therefore it was up to the trial judge as the fact finder determine whether or not it was foreseeable.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. That's the question we have today. It all boils down to whether the victim's act of ignoring her stop sign was foreseeable or not. If it was foreseeable, then we have a question of fact, whether there was an inefficient intervening cause or not. But, Your Honor, if it was not foreseeable as a matter of law, then it would be an efficient intervening cause. There's
Stop for one second. So you would acknowledge then that the issue here, as it relates to your argument that sole proximate cause, the issue is one of foreseeability. And then second, you acknowledge that that is a fact question, correct?
Partially agree and partially disagree, Your Honor. The issue does ultimately come down to whether the victim's act of driving out was foreseeable or not. That's the question here because that dictates whether there's proximate cause or not. But it is not a question of fact. It's a question of law because there is longstanding Nebraska precedent that goes back all the way to 1960 in Nicholas versus McArdle, which says that a traveler on a favored highway approaching an intersection protected by a stop sign of which he had knowledge and was legally privileged to assume that oncoming traffic would obey the stop sign. So, Your Honors, even if this is a fact question.
But you also, excuse me one second, but you also just cited two Irish. Doesn't Irish say that foreseeability is a fact question?
Your Honors, our contention is that it may be facts if there's any evidence in the record at all. The fact of the matter here is there was no evidence in the record discussing foreseeability. And that goes back to my original point, Your Honor, is that we're not asking this court to reweigh evidence, not asking you to look at the witnesses and judge who you believe more or not. This is looking at the record and seeing zero evidence, no matter how you construe it.
But if it is a fact question, are you not asking us to reweigh the evidence? Didn't the court make a factual determination that it is foreseeable?
Your Honor, implicitly in finding Mr. Solomon guilty, the court would have found that this was foreseeable and not an efficient intervening cause. I don't believe there was any explicit finding of fact as a matter with regard to that, Your Honor. But going back to my original point here is whether this is a fact question or a law question, there was no evidence in the record. So this court, as the public defender's office is well aware, Your Honors, is not in a position to reweigh the evidence on appeal. But what this court
isn't there evidence in the record that Mr. Solomon was speeding quite excessively, actually? And
yes,
isn't it reasonably foreseeable if you're speeding that you are going to be unable to stop as quickly as you would if you were complying with the law and following the speed limit?
Yes, Your Honor, those are both true. However, those both go to but-for causation, which is only part of proximate causation. The fact that Mr. Solomon was speeding, if he wasn't speeding, then maybe this accident doesn't happen. That only addresses part of proximate cause, the first element, but-for cause. That does not address the third element, which Irish lay out, which is the lack of foreseeability of an efficient intervening cause. So while if Mr. Solomon is speeding, it may be foreseeable that... Oh, I'm sorry. I couldn't tell if Your Honor had a question. If Mr. Solomon is speeding, it may be foreseeable that he is unable to stop if someone pulls out. But that's an issue of reaction, not foreseeing into the future whether she will pull out into the first place. So once she does pull out, and it's but for, you know, did Mr. Solomon have the ability to stop in time? That's a factual question. But that does not address the foreseeability of her ignoring her stop sign in the first place. So going back,
as it relates to the question of foreseeability, then, did the defense offer any evidence here to suggest there was anything about this intersection or anything that would suggest that this was not foreseeable when you have a driver driving at an excessive rate of speed in an uncontrolled intersection like this? I mean, eventually someone has to pull out from a stop sign, right? So is it not foreseeable if you're going at an excessive rate of speed that perhaps someone misjudges your speed as they're approaching?
No, Your Honor, the defense did not adduce any evidence at trial regarding that matter. The entire burden was on the state. the burden is always on the state in a criminal case. Proximate cause, which requires the absence of an intervening cause, is part of the state's burden. That burden will be on the state to introduce evidence of a lack of foreseeability. You know, and going to the question whether it was foreseeable if he was speeding, someone would pull out. The fact of the matter is Nebraska case law is clear that it is not foreseeable as a matter of law that someone would disobey their stop sign. The case law is clear that as a matter of law, someone driving down the highway has the privilege to assume others will obey their traffic signals. Otherwise, if you're driving to a green light, you would have to stop at your green light to make sure no one would go through the red light. Your Honors, with that, I'd like to reserve my time for rebuttal.
Mr. Self, I might ask one question before that. So if we were to agree with you that it's a question of law, wouldn't we have to say that there's no reasonable person who could say that was foreseeable or not foreseeable?
Yes, Your Honor. My answer is twofold to that. First is that you are correct because Nebraska case law is clear that this is not foreseeable as a matter of law. Because as I just said, you have a privilege to assume others will obey their traffic signs. And my second point, again, it doesn't matter if this is a question of law or fact, because the state did not introduce any evidence at trial regarding that matter. It doesn't matter how you look at it. We're not asking you to reweigh the district court's decision. The entirety of the record is void of any evidence regarding foreseeability. For that reason, Your Honors, Mr. Solomon is asking you to reverse the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Solomon. How much additional time, Ally, before we get going here, Mr. Lewis?
49 seconds.
Okay, if you would please add that to the Applebee's time. Mr. Lewis, please proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. Matt Lewis, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the state of Nebraska. This is a direct appeal of appellant's plea-based conviction of motor vehicle homicide, DUI, and reckless driving. Mr. Sullivan assigned several issues in this appeal, but we're spending most of our time talking about the overruling of the motion to dismiss relating to the proximate cause issue, so I'll just dive into that first. First, I'd just like to draw to the standard review. This was assigned as a rejection of the district court has overruled his motion to dismiss. And the motion to dismiss here, is talking about, the absence of any evidence that could possibly prove the conviction or the purported conviction, at issue in this case. So I'd first like to go there before getting to review the evidence and just say that this wasn't a straight sufficiency argument, as I think, we sort of may have just built this a little bit here. On that motor vehicle homicide point, Mr. Solomon largely argues that the victim had pulled out in front of him and that this becomes an efficient intervening cause, as described in State v. Irish, which he believes rendered him not the proximate cause of the victim's death. The legal standard provided in Irish for proximate cause is where a former event caused the latter, and is pretty much just that but-for causation test that we all know and love. They are interrelated. Proximate cause is a moving or effective cause or fault which, in the natural and continuous sequence, unbroken by an efficient intervening cause, produces a death or injury without which the death or injury would not have occurred. The three-point test that Irish establishes for proximate cause is that without misconduct, the injury would not have occurred, that the injury was a natural and probable result of the misconduct, and the three, that there was no efficient and intervening cause. The state would submit first that on one and two, the accident reconstruction concluded that had Solomon been driving the speed limit, the accident would not have occurred, that he would have missed the victim's car altogether. It is also reasonable to infer from that, had Mr. Solomon just been speeding a little bit, as motorists tend to do here and there, he may have either missed the victim's car altogether or may have hit a different part of the victim's car, which would not have resulted in their homicide by motor vehicle. But then also to point three, which I think is the really contested portion here, is about an intervening cause that supersedes and cuts off the causal link that relies on whether or not that intervening cause is foreseeable or not. The state would submit and detailed in its brief that the A motorist pulling out into a roadway is a completely foreseeable event, especially on a roadway that is busy. I believe this accident happened at about 6 o'clock on a busy day. Witnesses testified that there was a shopping center with a lot of people pulling out into the roadway. This particular roadway is typically busy. I've driven it myself. There's always a fair number of people. There are a lot of driveways coming in and out, both intersections with stoplights. There are also private drives and driveways in the businesses with stop signs. It was completely foreseeable that somebody would potentially pull out into the roadway. And getting back to that standard of review with a motion to dismiss, there was significant evidence and testimony provided that clearly showed that getting to that three-point test, but for Salmon traveling at the speed he was, the accident would not have occurred. Such an injury that was suffered by the victim was the natural and probable result of such misconduct by a speeding driver, was likely made worse because of the fact that he was impaired, and that the victim or any other motorist entry into the roadway was not so unforeseeable that it becomes an inefficient intervening cause for the purpose of destroying the causal link.
Mr. Lewis?
Yes, sir.
With regard to Mr. Sell's argument regarding foreseeability and that as a matter of law, people have the right to expect other people to obey traffic laws. How do you respond to that?
Well, so this is something that I think is addressed directly head on by the evidence. At trial, the state put on a witness who was the owner of the business that the victim left, who had surveillance cameras outside of his business. And those surveillance videos were presented in Exhibit 26, I believe. And the surveillance video shows that the victim drives out of the parking lot, hangs a right onto the entrance road, stops at the stop sign, brake lights and everything, comes to a complete stop, and then proceeds out into the intersection. So the stop sign, as far as I'm aware, in Exhibit 26, shows that she did stop. Maybe she did not stop long enough to let a speeding motorist come through, doing nearly 20 miles over the speed limit, pass down the road. However, a stop sign says to stop. Not necessarily to, you know, stop and you know, let a speeding motorist, you know, proceed down the road. So I would say that the law was followed. I mean, the victim's conduct might have been a little imprudent, but I think that it is also reasonable for a lot of motorists to think that somebody is not going to be doing that rate of speed, you know, down the road potentially.
And Mr. Lewis, are you aware of cases where it's been determined as a matter of law that the efficient intervening cause was not foreseeable?
I am not aware off the top of my head of cases where the efficient intervening cause was of the actual fact pattern of the case was not foreseeable. I know that it is discussed in Irish what a foreseeable and intervening cause would be potentially, such as somebody's driving down the road in I can't remember if this was in the court's opinion or in the briefs briefing that case that, you know, if somebody's driving down the road and a plane falls out of the sky and hits their plane or hits their car, that would be something that would be completely unforeseeable and would be completely, you know, an inefficient, and that would be in itself an efficient and intervening cause.
Let me ask you the same question then. Would you also acknowledge that the question of foreseeability is a fact question unless reasonable minds can't differ, or is it a question of law, like the issue of duty?
I think that it is a question for the fact finder to determine what is reasonable, is not reasonable, given the analysis that's put forward by Irish, that seems to be what is implied by that opinion there. So overall, I mean, the state would just, you know, concluding on this point, would say that the evidence presented at trial and considered by the court on the issue, you know, getting away from sort of the sufficiency analysis that this seems to have, you know, sort of taken a turn for, the state would just say that it's not just sufficiency. This is a motion to dismiss that was bundled in with, you know, having some of this evidence not being considered based on Mr. Salmon's, you know, belief that it was foreseeable or not foreseeable for the victim to pull out in front of him. And the state would just, you know, reiterate that this is a motion to dismiss. There was plenty of evidence that spoke to this issue specifically, both in the form of testimony. There's several videos. You have accident reconstruction that speaks to all these things. You have multiple photographs. You have some of the words of the victim himself that came out during the course of the trial, rendering a motion to dismiss on this issue not appropriate given the standards for the motion to dismiss standards that's out there. Unless there are any other questions on this, I would just briefly address some of the other topics in the brief before moving on.
Mr. Lewis, I'd like to just ask you straight up, would you agree that Exhibit 5 was inadmissible hearsay?
I do not think it is inadmissible hearsay. As I, the state makes, you know, quite clear in its brief, the state contends that blood and urine screen was not testimonial, so it's not definitional hearsay under 27803. And I think the case that we cite, Melendez-Diaz versus Massachusetts Supreme Court case, that specifically says that medical reports created for treatment purposes would not be testimonial, the decision there. I understand, Mr. Solomon, the phlebotomist that is testifying did not conduct the actual analysis of the blood test. She was part of the treating trial team when Mr. Solomon came into the hospital. She took the blood, submitted it to the lab, and then got the lab results back. It sounds like she was able to identify the lab results as matching the sample that she took, and then said that, yes, these were the things that were found in the sample. And so I would say to a point that the witness has the personal knowledge of the labs being taken, being submitted to the lab, and then the reports that are generally, generated as a result of that lab work. So I do think that Exhibit 5 was inadmissible. I would also just push back a little bit and say that, it wasn't the only example of a BAC reading that came out of this case. There was also Exhibit, I think it was 37, that was sort of your more standard form that was result of a warrant delivered by a law enforcement officer. They get a blood sample. That sample is then taken to the sheriff's office and then it is analyzed by a sheriff's officer, technician, a lab technician at the sheriff's office, who was able to come up with, sort of your more, in prosecution cases, a more run-of-the-mill BAC screening. With the other topics that are here that were addressed in Mr. Solomon's brief, the state would just submit on those what was submitted in the state's brief on those, unless there are further questions about that. Overall, the state asked the court to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, counsel. Judge Moore, anything else? Judge Bishop?
No, thank you.
Thank you. The matter is submitted. We thank you all. And Mr. Sell, thank you for appearing today.
Thank you, Your Honor, for having us.
Yes, I'd like to add to that. I know it's probably somewhat intimidating coming to before the court as a law student, and I just want to remark that I thought your presentation was very excellent. So nicely done.
Thank you
too, Mr. Lewis. Nice to see you.
Take care, everybody.
Thank you.